This is XTP Media.
This is a message for wives and girlfriends of aircraft enthusiasts. Ladies, we all know your other half has got far too many aviation books and magazines, cluttering up far too much space. So here is a brilliant solution. Encourage him to read The Aviation Historian. You see, it's a journal, a sort of cross between a magazine and a book. So it combines the two. And it's compact format, a bit like National Geographic. So it takes up less space. And it's quarterly, not monthly, so it takes up even less space still. And of course, it will keep him happily occupied for ages. It's not in the shops, so check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, and give yourself some space at last.
Hello, my name's Beatrice, and you're listening to Ascended. Enjoy the show.
Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 36 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me in the studio today are my very good friends and co-presenters, editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Great to have you back. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Slightly belated Merry Christmas to you, and obviously to Tim, even though you haven't introduced him yet. But I hope you've had a good one.
And of course, in the background there, you heard Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Merry Christmas, everybody, and possibly Happy New Year. If you're not listening to this late.
We record this on the 29th of December, and of course our thoughts and condolences go to the friends and families of those on AirAsia Flight 8501. Over to today's show, we've got a great interview for you today from someone who many describe as being Mr. Jaguar, Alan Vernon, along with a host of other content as well. Now, for those of you expecting this episode to feature our annual Aerospace X Awards, I'm afraid that due to the loss of our supporter for the awards, we've postponed them until we're in a healthier position and can find another supporter or sponsor to help us out. If you know anyone who can help, please do get in touch. We've also chosen in this episode to change our inserts, so we hope you have a bit of fun. We'll be featuring some outtakes and funny stories from some of our favourite programmes. We hope you laugh at them too. There's no pods challenge today. Amy's a little under the weather, so we all send Amy our very best wishes. So let's get started, and instead of picking up the latest news stories, we're just going to have a little round robin about some of the things that have caught our eye in the news, but also have a little look back at some of the things that we found memorable in 2014 and the things we're looking forward to in 2015. So let's start with some commercial news stories. We've just seen Qatar take delivery of the A350. That's now gone into service. I think it's going Doha, Frankfurt, I think, is it, Tim?
It sounds about right. You've cut me on the hop there, but yep, that does sound about right.
I didn't get to the launch. I don't think you were there. I think you were on leave as well, but it looked pretty impressive. Of course, we saw the A350 at Farnborough this year, and I've got to say I really, really like the aircraft.
It's a lovely-looking aircraft, yeah. I mean, you can't sort of argue with that. It's had, up until the very last minute, where there was a sort of last-minute hitch of around about sort of a few days, it's had an absolutely really, really smooth development and flight test
Yeah, the program's gone really, really well.
Very well.
Hasn't it?
I mean, what they've done is they've done a lot of you know, lessons have been learned from the A380. A lot of testing has been kind of pushed sort of earlier and earlier. A lot of simulation, a lot of kind of iron rig type work, even to things like the ventilation, cabin air conditioning or the IFE, all been tested to kind of death, and that's resulted in unbelievably smooth. If you look back at that, some of the other stuff that comparable programs, A380, we all know what happened there.
Yeah,
787. And the C series this year had problems there. A350 has really sort of sailed through. You know,
yeah.
Kudos to Airbus for that.
Yeah,
Tim,
absolutely.
Can I catch you on the hop as well?
Go on.
It feels like this has all been an incredibly smooth process as well. What actual timescale are we looking at from first flight of the aircraft to this delivery? When did the aircraft first fly?
Right.
Is it really? I just wondered if that would back up everything you guys have just said, because it really doesn't feel like it was that long ago that the aircraft took the first time.
Oh, hang on. I do know this one. It was actually on my birthday in 2013.
How did you forget?
And
2013.
And because that was the year that it did the flyby at the Paris Air Show. Yeah. The final day, did a flyby, there was a will they won't, you know, will it won't it turn up kind of thing, and it just made the sort of last sort of Friday of a fairly sort of June 2013. So
that's amazing, isn't it?
It benefits from it really benefits commercially from Boeing having all these problems with the 787. Boeing had got the 787 into service sooner and smoother, you know, it would wipe the floor with the A350. Absolutely, you know, wipe the floor. So no question about that. I think because there's a gap that's kind of opened up where people have, you know, customers have looked at the sort of delays between, you know, on the Dreamliner, and that gave Airbus the opportunity.
And Tim, the A350, obviously twin-engined aircraft, the A380, the last four-engined aircraft. Are we seeing the last of the four-engined aircraft? We're seeing A340s being retired at the moment. I mean, some as young as 9 and 10 years old. Do you think that we've seen the last four-engined aircraft for a while?
Well, it's an interesting. This is currently the $64 billion question being debated down in Toulouse and perhaps Seattle as well. And what we heard recently about the A380 was there was a big furore when an Airbus executive kind of hinted that they might kind of shut the program down after it breaks even. And that would be that. That was very apparently reportedly drew an angry response from the biggest A380 customer, Emirates. They see it as a you know, the backbone of their service. They see a bright future for it. It's had poor sales. I mean, this year they haven't had any sales. They've had the Japanese sort of carrier that's kind of pulled out, Skymark. You know, well, they're kind of terminated the contract with them. So there is this question now. There's a gamble here of Emirates. Emirates Tim Clark is holding out, saying, you know, look, you guys, what you need to do is you need to, you know, stretch it. You need to put new engines on it, new more efficient engines, and you need to market it better. You need to kind of tone down the luxury or aspect of it, and just sell it to airlines as just a cash generator. Stick a few more seats in there, and get the kind of profit margins up, you know, push that sort of aspect. But it's slow selling. So, and obviously, you know, we've already had the A320neo, we've had the A330neo. So Airbus has now sort of rode back a bit and said, they plan to do it at some time in the future. Haven't actually sort of said when. An A380neo, so that could be a sort of announcement, maybe 2015, maybe, sort of sometime next year. But again, it's a big gamble, you know.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier the C series seems to have gone very quiet. They obviously had the troubles with the engine failure earlier this year. Any news on that?
I think it's still doing. There's still been updates. It's obviously now flying, which it wasn't for quite some time this year. So they've got a lot of kind of time to catch up. And again, you're kind of wondering, well, how much sort of time they've lost to something like the A320neo, something like the 737 Max, you know, when they come in, you know.
Yeah.
If you're a customer, do you go for the C series, or do you wait perhaps and you sort of say, well, you know, I'll go for something that I'm tried and trusted from Airbus or Boeing, you know, they will deliver on time.
And of course, the other big debate in the commercial industry is what's going to replace the 757s, particularly stateside. It seems to be a bigger debate than anywhere else in the world. We've talked about the A321, I think, Neo potentially doing that, or the 737 Max having the capability to do that as well. There doesn't seem to be a natural replacement, but is the need for that aircraft gone? I mean, it was always a hot and high and a powerful aircraft, but the industry's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. It's one of those things that's a niche, and talking with Airbus and Boeing, well, Boeing particularly, and you sort of say, well, you know, 757 Max, and they kind of say, well, we're sort of studying. You know, it's one of the things we study, but you know, I think the question there would be, where would it go in their family?
Yeah.
Do you do an ultra long range version of the 737, or do you scale down the 787? You know, it sits between the two at the moment, and I think that would be the problem of having sort of simplified and got down to, you know, right, okay, 737 Dreamliner, 777. Remaining 747-8s, you know, where does that come in? You know, that's an extra sort of, you know, new family that we've just created. So been looked at, but time will tell.
Okay, so let's wrap that up then. Looking back at 2014, what do you remember for 2014 in terms of the commercial sector?
You know, obviously the whole civil aviation, and we've seen this in the last day, is being overshadowed really by MH370, MH17, the latest AirAsia aircraft. So those are really up profile, I suppose, if you'd call it, of aviation safety.
It's quite sad that it's taken those incidents really to bring an industry that's really proving to be quite a successful one, particularly in the air.
It's been a year so far in which it's had the lowest number of crashes, but the worst year in fatalities since 2005.
Yeah,
and one of these obviously is great. You know, if not the biggest aviation mystery so far. You know, where is MH370? Yeah. We've still not located it. You know, obviously there's still work ongoing, but that's and then the sheer bad luck of another Malaysian 777 being in the wrong place at the wrong time and being shot down.
Yeah.
Just tragedy upon tragedy.
Okay, well let me turn over to Gareth then. Gareth, what are your memories of the commercial sector in 2014? Anything stood out for you?
I think like Tim, it's been tainted by the disasters, hasn't it? I think when I look back at this year, I think probably A350 will be the one that really shines out to me, just because of the speed and the smoothness with which the program has run, the fact that we're now looking at this aircraft being delivered, and also, and I'm probably a little bit old-fashioned like this, the fact that it's a really, really good-looking aircraft. That always kind of means a lot to me, I think, to some extent. So
we're going to come back to the Boeing versus Airbus bit in some feedback later on, but I'll add my final bit to this segment before we move on to defence. One of the greatest memories I have this year is standing on the A350 with Frank Chapman, who's one of Airbus's test pilots. And our episode there featured some of the interview and the discussion that that we had with Frank Chapman, one of the nicest blokes in aerospace. And I really, really enjoyed speaking to him, learning a little bit about his story and just what an ordinary chap he is. And it was great to see him featuring in that video of the five A350s flying in formation. So some great memories there. Let's move on then. Let's move on to defence. Just before we look back and look ahead, one new story that's jumped out at me is the story about Norway, Poland and Holland looking to share aerial refueling capability and looking at the, of course, the MRTT, the A330 tanker. Gareth, there was a time when you'd never see those three countries in the same pot sharing resources.
No, I totally agree. And I guess in as a general point, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be the way forward, isn't it? We're, you know, people have got dwindling amounts of money available. There's dwindling numbers of types of aircraft available. So there's that, you know, they've got that sort of option to share a capability which ticks the boxes for all of them. And yeah, I guess it's, you know, setting up a tanker force, isn't it, for those three nations. At the moment they've all got the same aircraft to refuel. That, you know, their main strike fighter aircraft will be the F-16 for all three of those nations at present. So I guess it just, you know, I guess it makes sense, and it's an existing platform. I think the potential planned in service date something like 2019, which isn't very far away at all. And and these aircraft are incredibly flexible as well. They're not just, you know, air refuelers. They're, you know, they can transport stuff and people, and they can, yeah, they can be used for sort of medevac and other things like that. So I guess it's something that we should probably expect to see maybe more and more frequently.
Yeah, I suppose we've seen some of this in the sharing of NATO AWACS, I suppose.
Yeah,
I suppose that's we've seen these nations work together, so I don't suppose it's that surprising. So let's look back at 2014 then, Gareth. What stood out for you in the defence sector?
I guess you can't really talk about. I can't really talk about this sector without immediately thinking about the F-35. And, you know, the aircraft has, for one reason or another, has never been too far away from the news. From a very UK-centric perspective, and I know that we're lucky enough to have listeners from all over, but the aircraft was big news in July because we were all expecting to see it here for the first time. Obviously that didn't happen because an aircraft caught fire in the States, and that's just been just kind of one of the bookmarks, if you like, for this aircraft's you know, you kind of want to say burgeoning career, but it feels like it's been around forever already. And you know, and I know they're now gearing up towards July 1st, 2015. That will hopefully be initial operational capability for the Marine Corps in the States with the F-35B. That will be the first time that the aircraft in any of its guises has been declared operational. So the program's got a big 6 months ahead, not just in terms of the existing nations, but, you know, the Netherlands need to put their signature on a contract, which, you know, for their first few aircraft, which I believe they've committed to now. But the aircraft is, you know, it's a roller coaster, isn't it? And I know that when I speak to people in the Royal Air Force who are involved in the program, they're, you know, they'll say, don't believe the doubters, this is an extraordinary piece of kit. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it's got teething problems, even though we're however many years into the program. But when this aircraft is delivered and starts to mature as a system, it's going to be absolutely remarkable. And I guess with the amount of money that's been spent and will be spent and all of the ups and downs, we can only hope that that's true. So, yeah, you know, you kind of can't ignore it, can you? And and I guess we should probably expect more of the same next year.
Tim, how about you? What stood out for you in the defence sector?
Well, looking at the wider sort of geopolitical sort of arena, first off, we're back in Iraq. Surprise, surprise, and that's got a kind of a strange sort of set of pseudo allies all working together to combat Islamic State or ISIS or whichever name they're using or being using this week, where you've got RAF Tornadoes with Australian Super Hornets with American F-22s. And Iraqi Su-25s, and bizarrely, Iranian Phantoms. Deconfliction there must be very, very interesting. so that's one thing. Iraq is still there. It's still a running sore, and assets. And for example, UK Reaper UAVs now being deployed over there. That's something that's still ongoing. And I think obviously the second thing is Russia's resurgence. Almost daily reports of aggressive intrusions by Russian aircraft into sort of NATO airspace. Probing, testing. Back to the sort of good old days, I suppose, of the Cold War. But also some very dangerous incidents where they've been flying, kind of on airways with the transponders off, and coming close to airliners. It's really sort of that sort of thing, and stakes have been raised. Russia's economy is heading south quickly.
Yeah.
And all this oil money that has paid for, you think back to the 1990s where the Russian kind of fighter pilots or were driving taxis or something, the oil revenue and gas revenue has paid for, improvement, advancement and more flying hours for Russia's military and modernization. You think, is this going to happen again? Are they going to go back to that kind of sort of 1990s type? What is Putin going to do next? Is he going to lash out? I suppose the phrase would be cornered bear, but it's kind of a dangerous time,
Yeah, it certainly does feel like 20 or 30 years ago, certainly in this part of the world. I suppose from an aviation enthusiast's position, we're getting to see some fantastic photographs taken from, particularly from the western side of some Russian equipment we haven't seen for a while.
Well, the Baltic states sort of air show 2015 is one to watch, yeah.
Right, okay, well let's move on to space then, aerospace and space. It's of course 2014 was a very big year. We had a lot of coverage in the show and we've tried to balance that off. I know at the end of the year there seemed to be an awful lot going on, but pleased to see that Lunar Mission 1 reached its fundraising target and is off and going, so I'm sure Dr. Lewis Pino will be pleased about that. We've also of course seen NASA launch and recover Orion, but also in the background we've seen India just launch a test flight for a manned vehicle. We've seen the Russians launch their, I suppose, their equivalent of the Delta Heavy in the Angara, and China's not been quiet. They're now talking about a mission to Mars, space station, and also testing their own heavy carrier rocket. On top of that, Ariane 6 has been approved to be launched. So loads and loads going on in the space sector. Some good news, obviously some sad incidents at the back end of the year. But Tim, where do you stand in 2014 in terms of the space sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has, particularly in the UK, it's got a whole new momentum has built up, particularly in the UK. In the UK, as we said before in this program, it used to be sort of just satellites and a little bit of science, and we we're not going to get hands dirty on the kind of launches or bother with astronauts, that kind of thing's for somebody else. And so, we've now got we're going to take the lead role in Mars mission, Mars ExoMars,
yeah,
European mission. We've tripled our spending to the International Space Station. Tim Peake will obviously be going up in 2015. We're talking about now, you know, sort of spaceports. There'll be announcement in that. Should be announcement, and there's some kind of initial announcement. Maybe a kind of a short list in next month as to what the shortlist for UK spaceports. So, you know, it's going great guns. You know, only sort of fly in the ointment there would be can the industry deliver? You know. It's got Agreed. Politicians' attention. They now realise, wow, this is a high-tech sector that could provide jobs, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's now up to industry to deliver after being given this high-level backing.
Yeah, I was reading a report on the UK Space Agency's strategy, and it's 10, 15, 20-year plans for that. But we're already, I know it's only the first or second year in, but we're already off target. And although there's growth there, we're not quite hitting the targets we thought. But at the recent ESA Nations Forum, you know, €6 billion was agreed in terms of the contribution to space over the next couple of years, which is really great news for the industry. And hopefully we'll get our bit out of it as well. Gareth, how about you? What stood out for you in terms of aerospace and space?
I think it's quite a general point, Peter, and it's I think it's quite cool because to me it seems as if space has got exciting again, and it's capturing the imagination of perhaps a broader audience than it has done for some time, certainly maybe since the shuttle retired. And there's so much space news about. It's not all been great. Obviously, as you alluded to, we had the Virgin Galactic accident. But as a general point, it just feels, and you know, and Tim has been getting some great PR as well. He's been in national newspapers over here, and you know, you've got a Brit going back into space, and it's fantastic. And there's a lot of people talking about it. There's lots of people rushing outside to watch the ISS when it flies over, and we've got the astronauts with loads of followers on Twitter. Do you know what I mean? It's all these sorts of things are kind of coming together to make the whole subject exciting again and maybe picking up a whole new audience. And I think moving forward, that whilst it might not be a financial point, a commercial point or whatever, I think it's important that happens. You know, Tim, you said that, you know, you've got the politicians' interest again. You know, that is important. And let's just hope there's going to sort of be an awful sort of rocket related pun there, but let's hope the whole thing continues on the up and up. And yeah, let's hope that those growth targets can be met and that the momentum carries on, because that the interest is certainly out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, that's predominantly a look back at 2014. We've mentioned a few things there for 2015. Let's all pick something out then that we're looking forward to next year. Let's come back to you, Tim. What are you looking forward to in 2015?
The Tim Peake's mission would be a good one to look forward to. That will be something for the whole country to get behind. He's a great, like Gareth has said, you know, that he is a great ambassador, for kind of space generally, great ambassador for the UK, great ambassador for science. So that's going to be really good sort of, following his mission. Other thing I'm probably looking forward to, but it's going to be a big one, is the UK's SDSR 2015, the defence review. There was some hope that with the previous Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, getting things back on track, that this would put the defence budget back on an even keel. We would start to be able to afford things that we'd got rid of, you know, like the maritime patrol aircraft capability. We're now looking, you know, figures that have come out, we're now looking that there's going to be more austerity to come. So that is going to be, not good news. More pain to come. What else can we cut back? You know, in some respects, you know, air power has been cut to the bone already. You know, what else is left to go?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. How about you, Gareth? What do you think 2015 will bring?
Yeah, I just wanted to actually add to that point, Tim. I think the interesting thing is that, you know, we've already talked about Russia, and yeah, and the very, very public sort of probing and the response that has to come from the UK's Air Defence Forces. So it's going to be very interesting to see how those two things match up. But that's an interesting point. What I've got is a couple of things that come to mind for me. One of them, am I allowed to pick one that I picked last year? Because I'm still looking for to seeing the Joint Strike Fighter come over to the UK. Whilst I can't sit here and confirm or promise anything, I'm pretty sure there is a plan in place to make sure that happens in 2015, probably for the Royal International Air Tattoo. I'd be amazed if that doesn't happen, and I think we'll all be looking forward to seeing that. And the other thing, it's actually an anniversary, and it's the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain in 2015. And every time we get to one of these landmarks like that, obviously, you know, we have less and less of the people who were involved at the time, actually able to take part. And you know, the 80th would be the next one, but this realistically might be the last one with a reasonable number of Battle of Britain veterans to help us look back at those summer months of 1940. So I'm very much looking forward to that, and the I know a lot of the air shows and events will be doing things to mark that significant anniversary, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, have we got any more events like the Two Lanks coming up that you know about? Is there anything special that we might get to see this year we haven't seen before, do you think?
I'm not sure there's anything confirmed. Love to see the Mosquito come and visit. We may well get to see a Blenheim fly again at the air shows next year, because the aircraft already obviously is airborne. So let's hope that she's ready to participate publicly, which is always grand. But as ever with the air shows, you know, I think we all get into the new year, and then it feels like it's downhill sort of to May and June to start of the season, and lots of the news will happen in the months to come. So watch this space.
Okay. Tim, any thoughts on air shows this year? Which ones will you be going to for the society? Are there anything special you expect to do?
Well, we'll be covering the Paris Air Show, obviously, in great depth, as we usually do. Riyadh will probably be on the list as well. Like Gareth says, you know, the Battle of Britain anniversary, I think Duxford, September Duxford Air Show will be a must to be there. Visions of massed Spitfires, I think that'll be quite sort of lump in the throat type stuff. And you know, just see what happens. So you know, I mean, the other thing to note obviously is the centenary of World War One. You know, is still ongoing. So I wonder maybe whether there's kind of more chances of maybe some sort of Sir Peter Jackson's Air Force making up from New Zealand and being sort of swapped around, maybe, or put on the circuit. But we'll have to see.
Well, let's leave it there. After the break, we're going to hear from Alan Vernon all about one of our recently departed aircraft in the UK inventory, the Jaguar. I caught up with Alan in between his day job and volunteering duties, and we talked everything Jaguar.
So I am always looking to entertain myself, and lots of times we have federal air marshals, you know, the air marshals on the plane who are armed guards, and I've wanted to get them to tell stories for the podcast, but they are not very forthcoming with stories because of all the secrecy. So one of the things I do like to ask them is, what cover do they use with the passengers next to them? You know, because you're on a 9-hour flight, the passenger next to you is at some point probably going to ask you what you do for a living, and you can't say you're an air marshal. So I like to ask them, you know, because I figure they should probably come up with creative things, you know, like I'm in the mortuary business, or I would have fun with it. But so I asked them, and I asked the one guy, he's like, oh yeah, I tell myself fitness equipment because it's boring and they won't ask, you know, any more questions. And another guy said the same sort of thing. He said, I tell myself insurance because nobody wants to hear about that, because basically they don't want to ask a lot of questions because then eventually they might get caught in a lie or look, you know, suspicious. And then there was a nice looking black air marshal, and I asked him, what do you tell people? And he said, I tell them I'm just out of prison. He goes, shuts them right up. That was the best answer I'd had.
7 San Diego International. I don't think I've ever flown into or out of San Diego.
I have, and it was not memorable. But I do, before I die, I want to buy something from the duty-free shop.
You never have?
Never have?
Yeah.
Well, first off, you had me at duty-free. Like, when I see a sign that says duty-free, I want to go hang at that place.
Yeah.
It's always said it's the best lit place on the planet. It glows.
If you want to buy a gallon of perfume, that's where you go.
Well, I'm like eyeballing like the 55-gallon drum of Grey Goose.
Yeah.
I actually tried. I tried to buy like a Toblerone log once or something in there. And it was one of these things, and I don't know if you guys have ever done this, but you guys have low self-esteem, right? Okay. You've gone through your whole life just walking past the duty-free store of life going, well, that's not for me. That's for other people. That's for people who have...
Isn't it only for international travelers?
I don't... I never
it
know.
Used to be, it used to be, and now everyone can shop.
I never knew. I never knew the answer. I walked past it a million times, and one time about a year ago, I was going through LAX, and I was like, I got money. I'm responsible. I'm an adult, and the hot chick behind the counter, she doesn't know I'm a loser, and she doesn't know my family's a piece of shit and all that kind of stuff. I'm going in there, and I'm going to buy something from the duty-free shop there. And I walked into the place, and I was like, give me that big bottle of Jack Daniels. And she's like, do you have a ticket to Zurich? And I was like, I'm going to Phoenix. And she's like, well, you can't buy anything. And I was like, you know what? My fault for trying to be a f***ing human being. Like, I will never try this again. I thought for 10 minutes that I could join the rest of adults in the real world. No, she spotted me coming a long time.
Right.
She's like, she spotted me at the Cinnabon, and she's like, buzz off, loser.
You smelled like domestic travel.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about, of course, the Jaguar, a bit of an unsung hero. But before we talk about the aircraft, tell us a little bit about your aviation and aerospace background.
Yes, well, presently I'm a licensed aircraft engineer working for a regional airline and have been for a few years now. But I started off in the RAF in 1984 as an airframe technician, and about half of my 25 years experience in the service was working on the Jaguars on 6th Squadron in the station engineering hangar, which was AMF at RAF Coltishaw, and on mobile repair teams.
What was the sort of process that you went through to become, as I now know, the expert in the aircraft that you are?
Well, originally, I mean, I first worked on the Jaguars as on the RSS Abingdon repair teams. This was in 1990 after the... start the Gulf War work up. 4 aircraft were damaged in bird strikes, and I was involved in the repair team. We was actually working in 6th Squadron's hangar when they were deployed at Fumray. I was posted to Coltishaw into the aircraft maintenance flight in 1992. Worked in there for 8 years, had a break on Harriers, and then went to 6th Squadron until the end at Coningsby in 2007.
Did you specialise in any particular part of the airframe? Were you particularly involved in
mainly structures, structural repairs and systems as well, airframe systems. And then on 6th Squadron I was just on the airframe desk and also in the sort of back office staff.
Okay, and the sorts of repairs that you would undertake to something like bird strikes, how badly were these aircraft damaged?
The worst one I did was a 41 Squadron aircraft, which was suffered a bird strike on the nose. It's a fairly simple structure in the front of the Jaguar, basically frame stringers and stress skins. That repair took a year to do.
Wow. Wow, okay. Well, listen, let's talk then a little bit about the aircraft. Bit of an unsung hero. As I grew up, it was always there, but now it's gone and out of service. Let's start by seeing where the aircraft came from. Where did it originate? What was the demand for the aircraft?
Well, originally, the RAF air staff had a target document, which was AST 362, which was for an advanced trainer with supersonic performance, good short field performance, and advanced avionics suites to guide the trainee pilots from the Jet Provost onto the TSR-2 and the other projects that were being designed at the time in the early 60s. Again, it was looking for an aircraft which had reheat, and they were looking at variable geometry as well for a trainer.
Why was that, Alan? Why were they looking particularly for those sorts of aircraft specs?
Basically because the Gnat and the Hunter, which were used training, was sort of like second-generation jet aircraft and were just not that advanced enough. There was too big a gap between those aircraft and, say, the likes of the TSR-2.
Yeah.
So that was the whole reason for the specification.
Right, okay. But this wasn't only a demand for an English aircraft, was it? The French were looking for an aircraft at the same time.
Yes, they were. I mean, they were looking for an aircraft for basic weapons training and for light ground support as well to replace their types that were in service. Again, that was for a subsonic aircraft and without the advanced avionics. There were some similarities between the two specifications, and the two air forces were looking in the early 60s towards basically commonality. But that wasn't until the Labour government came in 1964 where serious negotiations took place.
And so how did this all come together to end up being the Jaguar then?
Again, with the Labour government coming in and sort of like the reviews with TSR-2 and other aircraft were cancelled, they were looking for basically collaborative projects to reduce the costs. Again, the French themselves, their programme for the ECAT, which is what their program was called, was more advanced than the British with the aircraft that were actually being tendering. They had four aircraft companies that tendered for the process. They were more advanced in the tendering process, and basically the Breguet 121 was chosen before the collaborative project was started.
From what I understand, Britain and France joined together to jointly develop the aircraft. I think about 300 were originally looked at. How did it get from drawing board and design to some sort of workable test aircraft?
Okay, well, originally with the Memorandum of Understanding, which was signed in 1965, the Jaguar was one project within four. Again, it was for a training aircraft for the RAF and for the French as well. However, at the same time, there was the Anglo-French variable geometry combat aircraft, which was in the same memorandum, and helicopters and missiles as well. So it wasn't just a part of that memorandum. Again, sort of with the Breguet 121 being chosen, that was basically taken as the baseline design for the aircraft, and BAC and Breguet then developed the airframe towards a joint specification that had been written, which included supersonic performance. The French design was modified with a thinner wing, changes to the tailplane, the requirement for the RAF for having a raised cockpit at the rear for the instructor to have a better view out of the aircraft. Basically, that design process went through 1965 to 66, where a joint specification was issued. The brochures were issued for the actual design to fulfil that specification.
And this was around the time the British, obviously TSR-2 had gone, the F-111 was on the table, but that was coming into some trouble, and the RAF needed their single-seat attack aircraft, didn't they? They weren't getting what they wanted. What happened
next?
Yes,
well, they had...
Yeah.
Well, in 1966, basically, the British changed their specification or their requirements from the 150 trainers that they originally were looking for, requiring 90 attack aircraft, single-seaters, with advanced avionics. So basically, again, that was turned into 90 aircraft, and there was 110 trainers as well. And the French up there ordered to 200 aircraft as well, with 50 maritime Jaguars.
Right. Okay. So originally the Jaguar for the French was a maritime version.
Well, the French were looking for a strike aircraft for their carrier force. So they looked at the Jaguar and thought, yes, we can bolt this requirement onto the SEPICAT project.
So joining together, obviously there were at that time engineering challenges of metric and an imperial, but 67 saw the first, as they say, first metal cut, and the aircraft come together. Did it look like a Jaguar at this time, as we recognise it today?
It looked similar, but there were some changes to the airframe, which came through flight testing, which made from the change from the original version. There was originally 8 prototypes that were ordered for the project. Because the French required the aircraft in a quicker timescale than the RAF, the first 4 prototypes were French. They had the first 2 prototypes were trainers, the next 2 were single-seaters for the attack version, the A. The 5th one was the Maritime Jaguar, and then the last 3 prototypes were the British ones, which was 2 single-seater S versions, and the last aircraft was the B version, which is a British trainer, which is actually supposedly the first pre-production aircraft.
And testing didn't go too well. There were some challenges, weren't there? Some engine problems and that sort of thing. But eventually, the British cancelled the order for the trainer and went straight for their strike aircraft order.
Yes, that was in 1970, with basically the NATO requirements for Germany, and because the Phantoms that had been ordered and entered into service would be used for ground attack aircraft, and basically the shortfall of air defence aircraft with the Lightning. Basically, it was decided that the aircraft had been developed was too capable to be an advanced trainer, and basically the order was changed to 165 strike aircraft for the RAF and 35 trainers.
Right, okay.
Purely for conversion training.
Right. Okay. So they presumably went to set up the OCU and orders started arriving. Let's talk about the aircraft in service, though. I suppose that's what we all remember it for.
Yeah.
Where did its service history start? What role did it perform in its service life?
Well, first of all, I mean, the first deliveries of the aircraft were made to the French in sort of early 1973. The French had 3 wings of the aircraft, which was the 7th, the 11th, and the 3rd wings. The first 2 had 4 squadrons, and the 3rd had a single squadron in it. That was the 160 single-seaters that the French had ordered, and with 40 E-trainers.
Right.
The RAF themselves, basically the aircraft came into service in September 1973 with a Jaguar conversion unit up at Lossiemouth, but it wasn't until March 1974 that 54 Squadron stood up for training and became the fighter squadron in July. The RAF themselves had another 7 squadrons formed up to the beginning of 1979, and with the SDU doing the training.
You know, we've talked about its service, I suppose, more recently in the Middle East. Where else did it serve for the RAF? What roles did it undertake?
Well, its main role in Royal Air Force Germany was as a nuclear strike aircraft. 4 squadrons at Bruggen had that commitment, and then there was a 5th Germany squadron, which was for tactical reconnaissance, which was based at Lahrbrück, being right. Number 2.
Okay, and talking about the aircraft as itself, we talked a little bit about its design and its evolution. It was a twin-engined aircraft. It was powered by Rolls-Royce engines?
Yes, the outdoors.
What sort of performance did the aircraft deliver?
As a supersonic aircraft, it was more transonic than supersonic. It could fly supersonic high altitude, and the two-seater, if it was clean, could actually reach 1,000 miles an hour. But again, at low level, supersonic performance is not that important.
Yeah. And what sort of armament did the aircraft carry in its various forms?
Well, when it was in the nuclear role, it would carry one WE-177 tactical nuclear weapon. Could carry cluster bombs, iron bombs. Originally, it was designed to carry SNEB rocket packs as well on the outboards, but they were not really used.
Right, okay.
As such. Of course, the Jaguar, later in its life, was able to carry the 3 generations of Peiwei laser-guided weapons. It was also fitted with the GBU-86 cluster bomb munition for Gulf War 1, and also the CRV-7 rocket launch system.
And what about self-defence? What was its self-defence capability?
The original RAF Jaguars only had a radar warning receiver.
Okay, you're on your own, chaps.
Yes, fine, basically, yes. The aircraft itself, when it was in service with the RAF originally, had issues with basically the navigation equipment, the original NAVWAS system. was good when it worked, but was very unreliable. Yeah. It was first generation digital system. In fact, the Jaguar was the first European aircraft to actually have a digital attack system on it. And with ergonomic issues, basically crews started to complain about the serviceability of the equipment, because when the navigation kit failed, it failed big time. And yeah. Basically the aircrew had lost all navigation, ability to map and stopwatch again.
Yeah.
Also, with sort of like the changes to basically the Warsaw Pact air defences in the late 70s and early 80s, the aircraft having just the pure RWR system required a better defensive suite. So these modifications were brought in with the GR1A in the mid 80s. Basically, the navigation equipment was changed to the Finn 1064 system from Ferranti.
Right. And what capability did that give it that it didn't have before?
The kit was more reliable and it had a lot more memory to it. As I said, the original NavWest had like 8K of memory.
Right, okay. Okay, which seems crazy in this day, but of course at the time it was a very different one.
Matter of electronics, yeah. Yes it was.
Yeah. And so it predominantly saw service in Europe, but the cooperative did sell internationally as well, didn't it?
Yes, it did. The major problem with the Jaguar itself was when it was originally designed, exports was part of the collaborative agreement.
Yeah.
And many countries were actually approached during the development of the Jaguar to see if they would like to come on board for the project. Germany was, I think Turkey and the Benelux countries were as well.
Yeah.
However, towards the end of the development phase with the aircraft coming into service, Brezhou had been taken over by Dassault in the late 60s. And while they were signed up for the contracts for the 400 aircraft, Dassault themselves particularly weren't interested in the export versions and gave BAC all the export possibilities. Of course, when BAE were putting in tenders to foreign air forces, Dassault were in direct competition with their own airframes, like the Airbarge F1.
Yeah, so, bizarre situation.
It was, yes.
Bizarre situation. But, you know, for those of us who know, we saw, obviously, the aircraft go to India. I suppose I recognise the Omani Jaguars. I don't know why. Maybe it's photographs of them in the desert. I don't know. But
Skin was quite distinctive.
Yeah, that's right. But it also went to Nigeria and Ecuador as well. I didn't know.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I mean, the Ecuadorians actually used them in combat service in some of their border conflicts with Peru.
Right.
The Nigerians, of course, the aircraft were never paid for. They were out of service in a short length of time because they had no spare support.
And what about India? Because India continued to use them for some time after we'd stopped using them, didn't they?
The Indians will be using them for a lot longer.
Yeah.
Presently at the moment, I think they've still got like 125 airframes. Originally, the 160 airframes they bought, 40 were built at Warton in Lancashire, and the rest of the versions were licensed, built by HAL.
Right.
In India themselves.
And what would be the differences between, I suppose, the export version and the version used by the RAF and the French Air Force?
Well, the French Air Force themselves, the aircraft was very, very basic compared to the avionics suite for the RAF. And it was never upgraded to like the RAF aircraft was. The export versions originally were based on the S version, so they had the British avionics kit.
Right.
And the Indians have developed their kit through the Darwin 2 system, and presently are looking to upgrade it again to the Darwin 3 system.
Right, okay. So if you want to see a Jaguar flying in the world today, India's your last opportunity, is it?
It is, and it will be for some time. The Indian government actually, in the late 90s and early 2000s, ordered another 37 to be built, so those aircraft have some considerable flying time left.
But all's not lost here, and you're involved with an aircraft that's being rebuilt, and for those who followed you, particularly on Facebook, the airframe seems to be progressing well. Tell us a little bit about X-Ray 741.
Okay, the aircraft is a GR1 airframe, which is the original build number of S-38. It was assembled at BAC Warton in 1974 and first flown on the 4th of October of that year. It entered service on the 18th of November up to the 226 SOCU at Lossiemouth. And during its time in service, it served on 54 Squadron and 6 Squadron at Coltishaw. In that 20-year period, it was one of the first 12 aircraft to go onto Operation Granbury in 1990. On its return, it was modified to the Stage 2 Granby mods. However, it was never a Gulf War flyer during the war.
What's a Granby mod?
The Granby mods was the desert modifications and the self-defense upgrades which were made to the aircraft before the commencements of Desert Storm.
Right, okay. Sorry, understand.
Basically, on its return to the Gulf, it was modified to the Stage 2, but because the war had finished before the next reassignment of aircraft, it was demodded and went into service with the OCU again until 1994, when it was put into deep storage at Shawbury.
So how did you get hold of it?
It was disposed of by the MOD to Ever Aero in 2005, and the Bentwaters Cold War Museum, which I'm a member of, bought the airframe in the October of 2009 for plans to restore it.
And just before we come back to the aircraft, the Bentwaters Cold War Museum, tell us a little bit about that before we come back to the aircraft.
All right, the Bentwaters Cold War Museum is based at the old USAF Air Force Base at Bentwaters Park, which is at Rendlesham in Suffolk. The actual museum itself is based in the former Hardened Command Wing Command Post Building, which was basically the nerve centre for the twin bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, when the US Air Force was actually operating out of there. It's a charity organisation which is operated and administered by volunteers from the Bentwaters Aviation Society, which is a group of about 200 members, which set the museum up in 2007.
So let's come back to 741. She was in deep storage. Where are you at now with her restoration, and what's the objective here?
Right. The restoration originally was to basically restore the airframe to as complete condition as possible. The actual team that started on the aircraft in 2009 got the aircraft refitted the wing, resprayed the externals in the markings of 6th Squadron during 1980, and rebuilt the cockpit as well, because the cockpit had been completely stripped. We're still missing some components from the cockpit, like the navigation equipment, but hopefully we can source some.
Yeah. How operational, I suppose, are you going to get this aircraft? Because I've seen some videos online, and there's lots of moving parts on it, and it looks almost like it's airworthy.
Unfortunately, it never will be airworthy. The airframe itself is got about another 1,500 hours of flying time on it and fatigue life, but the wing itself was robbed at Shawbury in the mid-90s, and the wing that we received was LifeX as far as flying.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no chance of that, and of course, basically with CAA regulations, it cost millions to restore it into a flying condition.
Right, okay. So how far are you going to take this restoration then?
Hopefully, if we can get hold of engines and other equipment required to run the aircraft, we might get it to a taxable standard and ground running.
Very exciting. It's been a long time since I've heard a Jaguar. It'd be great to hear one again in the UK. So just to wrap up then, Alan, on the aircraft and the work that you're doing, will she remain Bentwaters Cold War Museum, or is there a plan to move her? Will we be able to see her? Can we see her now?
Well, presently at the moment, the aircraft is in a restoration hangar at Bentwaters with quite a bit of work to do it, so it's not on public display at the moment. Hopefully, later in the year coming up, we shall have her out for displaying our hydraulics and electrical systems.
Yeah.
The engines depend on availability. You can't really get by an outdoor on eBay. Well, you can, but it's not going to be a runner.
Yeah. Would that sort of be likely sourced from somewhere like India?
We have got a source possibly for our doors at the moment, which we're in negotiation with, but it's going to cost the museum money, and it's a case of time of when and where.
Okay, well, let's talk about how listeners can get involved then if they want to support the project and hear about you and see you online. Whereabouts can they find out a little bit more, Alan?
Well, the museum has its has a website, which is available online. If you just put in Bentwaters Cold War Museum, the museum is advertised with its own website. We're on Facebook as well, on the Sepikat Jaguar Appreciation Society.
Yeah, it's a pretty good and a pretty active site, that, isn't it? So
it is.
For those who haven't been on there, it's well worth a look. There's some great material on there.
Yes, I mean, there's material that covers the Jaguar from beginning to end, basically.
Yeah.
We have members from the BAE Heritage Centre up at Walton who will put on images from sort of like early prototype development and manufacturer, all the way through to some Indian members who occasionally put some pictures on.
For most of the stuff that I've seen, these are people who are real enthusiasts about the Jag, aren't they?
Oh, there's experts from sort of like from air crew, ground crew, stories from everywhere.
Yeah, one of the better groups, one of the better groups. Okay, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything you just want to say or ask for just before we leave?
I think we've covered everything there, okay. Peter. Thank you very much.
All right then, Alan. Listen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Really enjoyed talking to Alan there. Who's got fond memories of the Jag? It seems to have gone and it's not forgotten, but it sort of just drifted out. And we've got none left now.
Alive and well in India,
of course.
Quite an advanced form these days. But yes, no longer. Since Six Squadron disbanded, we no more Jags in the UK, and the French ones have gone as well. For me, it's a really important aircraft. I spent a lot of summer holidays at the famous crash gate at RAF Coltishall in Norfolk, watching and photographing the Jags. I've been really lucky since Global Aviation Resource came into being to interview a number of Jaguar pilots about flying the aircraft, and also a lot of some of the Typhoon pilots we've interviewed, people like Scott Loughran, who was the display pilot in 2009, Tim Clement, 2010. A lot of the Jaguar force went on to the Typhoon as well. So there's still Jaguar pilots knocking around in the Air Force today. And there's some very interesting comparisons about going from Jaguar to Typhoon, the power being the notable difference. You know, the old gags about, you know, needed the curvature of the earth and you have to put the burners into taxi and all of these sorts of things. But it was a wonderful aircraft, and it was an incredible weapon system, and particularly in the first Gulf War, you know, the aircraft was absolutely faultless, but it was also run by a fantastic group of people. The Jaguar Force was always a brilliant group of people, both the air crew and the ground crew, and that was an important part of it.
And the thing that I sort of picked up when talking through some of the post Jaguar service days with Alan is how involved a lot of those people still are, either in restorations or enthusiast groups, and the group on Facebook's really active. I just saw someone pop up from Australia, I think, who's got a Jag cockpit with a refueling boom that works, and just popped up completely out of nowhere, and everyone jumped on it and started chatting to them. It really sounds like an active group to these days as well. I suppose the thing for me was that I didn't know that the original French requirement for the Jag was for a naval version. That would have been interesting.
Certainly would.
Yeah, needed a hell of a catapult.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how they would have got it off the decks, but obviously that was pretty short-lived, and we know where their requirement went on to after that. I think the other thing that Alan quite interestingly highlighted in the interview there was that, of course, as BAE, as it then was, well, British Aerospace went on to try and upsell the Jag abroad. Of course, the French had other products in the portfolio that they were more interested in selling, so weren't that interested in the export version. So I suppose it was always going to be short-lived.
The Jaguar also has a unique claim to fame in that it was... was it the RAF's air-to-air missile kill in 1982?
Yep, indeed.
I'm just looking at the details here, where a 14 squadron Jaguar was shot down by a 92 squadron Phantom in West Germany, with a bit of switchology errors and someone taking an airborne and armed aircraft.
Right.
Just to add, the pilot, who I think might have been Steve Riggs, from off the top of my head, did eject safely from the Jaguar that day. And there is a wonderful story that I was told by an old Jaguar pilot at Coningsby that a few years or some time after that, Steve Griggs was flying a Jaguar on a training sortie over one of the ranges in the UK, and it all went terribly wrong. I think the engines caught fire on his Jaguar, and he had to eject from the aircraft a second time. He told a story that just before he pulled the handle, he looked over his shoulder and he said he was expecting to see an F4 there.
Very good, very good. Well, listen, I don't think we got everything we could out of Alan, and as you say, Gareth, there are some great JAG pilots still around, so we might just see if we can take that discussion on and maybe get a JAG pilot back on the show to talk about what it was like to fly. So we'll see if we can do that possibly in 2015 sometime. Okay, after the break then, over to you, Tim, on the X10 R Top 10.
Story comes along that plugs so perfectly into things that you've been ranting about, Adam, that it gets tweeted to me thousands and thousands of times, like when they extended the uprights. I'm trying to think if there's been a story that's been tweeted to me as many times as the one that I am still getting, which is, and I'm sure you know where this is headed, someone's emotional support pig was booted off of an airplane.
Yes.
So a passenger on a U.S. Airways flight was leaving Connecticut's Bradley International Airport. She was flying to Washington. She brought a pig on board, a 70-pound emotional support animal. It was a pig on a leash.
70?
Yeah, 70. In fact, a passenger who took a photo of it.
It's a down song, isn't it?
A passenger thought that she was carrying a duffel bag, but then realized it was a pig. And the reason that the animal got kicked off, because pigs are allowed on planes as long as they aren't disruptive, but this fellow or lady was disruptive and squealed and in the aisle. So people were freaking out, so they got kicked off.
First off, this thing was 70 pounds. First, number one. Number two,
slim for a pig.
In the movie I just finished, not the Paul Newman one, but the independent movie, Allison is in the scene where I say to the woman who has the dog, what happens when the dog has to use the bathroom? And she says, what happens when you have to use? And I say, I don't in the aisle.
Well, keeping with the animals on flights, and a little different example is, you know, there was an article recently about a woman. This is actually in Hartford, close to me, who brought a pig on board a plane and claimed that this was an emotional support pig, and the airline didn't think much of that, and you know, threw the woman and the pig off the plane.
You sure it wasn't her husband? I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I was just wondering.
Yeah, that was maybe another flight, but
or there was some Aiken for her bacon.
Oh, boy. Oh no, this is going downhill quick.
Tim, over to you.
Okay, well, it's time for extended top 10, and this month it's the top 10 carrier aircraft. At number 10, Sea Fury. A big British brute of a fighter, the Hawker Sea Fury was perhaps the ultimate in piston engine fighter technology. Too late for World War II, it acquitted itself well at the dawn of the jet era in the Korean War, where a Sea Fury shot down a MiG-15. Modified Furies still compete in the Reno air races up to today. At number 9, FA-18 Hornet. The losing fighter in the 1970s fly-off against the F-16, the McDonnell Douglas, now Boeing, F-18, a bigger Super Hornet follow-on, has matured into a classic all-round multi-role naval fighter and attack aircraft. It's been the backbone of US naval aviation since the 1980s, as well as winning several export orders. The latest Super Hornet features longer range, better sensors, and even an electronic warfare variant, the EA-18G Growler. At number 8, Dauntless. A rugged two-seat dive bomber, the Douglas SBD Dauntless played a critical role in the Pacific for US flat tops. But perhaps its finest hour, or in fact minutes, was at the Battle of Midway in 1942, when Dauntlesses attacked and sank or crippled three Japanese carriers within 6 minutes, arguably turning the tide of the Pacific War. At number 7, Rafale. France's naval aviation may be in a fraction of the size of the US, but the Dassault Rafale M entered this list as the first 4th Gen Plus fighter to go to sea and to war, making its combat debut over Afghanistan in 2007, and then conducting ops over Libya, Mali and Iraq. The land-based variant of the Rafale also has the French nuclear strike mission. At number 6, F4 Phantom. What can one say about the legendary McDonnell Douglas F4 Phantom? Powerful, radar-equipped, naval, multi-role fighter, the proof of the Phantom's prowess, it was adopted almost immediately by the USAF, despite its naval heritage. In Vietnam, too, it was US Navy Phantom crews who, thanks to Top Gun combat to score, began to reverse the kill ratio against North Vietnamese fighter pilots. Still going strong today, in a handful of air forces, the Phantom is the classic example of how a good naval aircraft makes a good land-based one. At number 5, Hellcat. After the shock of encountering the fearsome Japanese Zero, the Grumman Hellcat was key to turning the tide of battle in the air in the Pacific in World War II. Flying from US Navy carriers, Hellcats destroyed over 5,200 Japanese aircraft, the most of any naval fighter, most famously in the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot in 1944, where Hellcats wreaked havoc on poorly trained Japanese pilots in the last carrier v. carrier battle of the war. Little known Avgeek fact, US Navy Hellcats were actually used in Europe, covering the invasion of the south of France in August 1944. At number 4, Sea Harrier. Originally designed to shoot down long-range Soviet bears and backfires threatening NATO fleets in World War III, the UK's Sea Harrier, an air-to-air optimised development of the Jump Jet Harrier, won its spurs in 1982 during the Falklands conflict. There, in atrocious weather that sometimes would have grounded cat and trap fighters, small force of Sea Harriers protected the counter-attack force and downed 20 Argentinian aircraft, with only one Sea Harrier lost to ground fire. The follow-on Sea Harrier FA-2, meanwhile, became the first European fighter to be armed with AMRAAMs and flew strike missions over former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Now, number 3, A6M-0. Light, long-range and manoeuvrable, the existence of the Mitsubishi AM-60 came as a strategic shock to US intelligence that started a war with Japan, despite reports of this fighter from US flyers fighting in China. Outclassing anything allied in the air at the start of the war, improved tactics and better trained US pilots negated some of its early advantages, along with its lack of armour. However, right up to the end, it was still a threat to be feared by US sailors as a piloted guided bomb in the form of suicide kamikaze attacks. At number 2, Swordfish. It may have two wings, need a calendar instead of a speedo, and it looked like it came out of a World War I junk shop, but the Fairey Swordfish is one of the most significant aircraft on this list. It flew from 1939 to 45 in a multitude of roles, even outlasting its successor. It played key roles in the World War II's most crucial naval actions, crippling the Bismarck, sinking the Italian fleet at Taranto, and the Battle of the Atlantic. Flying the slow, vulnerable stringbag, these FAA aviators needed a special kind of courage. And at number 1, it has to be the F-14 Tomcat. For sheer power, looks, and Hollywood style, the number 1 carrier aircraft has to be the Grumman F-14 Tomcat. Whether sweepbacks going supersonic or flapped gear and hooked down dirty in the pattern, the Tomcat looks amazing from every angle. Though its US Navy air-to-air combat record does not match others on this list, it was on the celluloid screen that the Tomcat scored its biggest victory, introducing a generation of teenagers to fighter aircraft in Top Gun. Much loved and much missed, the Tomcat was finally retired in 2006. Fun fact, the F-14's pilots with the most air-to-air kills were Iranian, the F-14's only export customer. So that's my top 10 of carrier aircraft. How about that? Any missed off there?
I was wondering if the Swordfish would get in, obviously for purely selfish reasons. So pleased to see that in. My heart just says I can't disagree with the Tomcat. Surprised to see the Rafael in there. Got to talk to a Rafael pilot during this year at Yeovilton, I think. Very, very interesting guy. And got a close up of the aircraft. It really is quite a good looking aircraft, actually. But a bit surprised about that. No, I like that list.
Gareth, anything you have on there?
Tim. Your X-10s are brilliant, but I'm going to have to call something this time out. Blackburn Buccaneer. I'm not saying Buccaneer wouldn't be top, but it would definitely be in my top 10. I have to say.
But was it known for its carrier? I mean, best known for carrier, or was it best known for its land based sort of being adopted by the RAF?
Oh, I just think, you know, sort of HMS Eagle with Sea Vixen. There's another one could go on. Maybe I'm just being a bit too patriotic. I don't know, but those two would stick out. There's one the Skyhawk is another. It's another classic.
Skyhawk almost made it on there. Skyhawk. You know, again, still being used today. You know, it's
yeah,
still...
incredible.
Do you know what? Say, do you know what? You could do a top 20, couldn't you? You could do a top 20 on carrier aircraft.
Whilst I don't think it would be in the top 10, one of my favourite, and I know that's a fairly loose term, was the Vigilante.
Okay.
Just an incredible.
Wow.
Huge hulk. I mean, you think they put some incredible aircraft on carriers back in the day, didn't they? Yeah. Enormous great things, you know. But it's a cracky list. And, hey, listen, you cannot argue with the turkey at number one, I don't think. It is just it's the iconic naval strike fighter, isn't it?
And it's also you know, when people... You know, when somebody says carrier aviation, or, you know, somebody who knows nothing about, you know, aircraft whatsoever, someone says, you know, aircraft carrier, and you know, that is the thing that they'll point to, or the picture they'll draw up in their head.
Yeah, and actually, you could say to people on the street, do you know what the F-14 Tomcat is? And if they said no, you could say to them, it's the one that was in Top Gun, and they go, that one,
yeah.
So it kind of, it's the one that cut through, I suppose, into the sort of public consciousness. So it can't argue with that at all.
Great list, Tim. Well done.
Yeah. So glad the Swordfish made it on. It's going to be your last episode.
Yeah, absolutely. The old string bag. Like to see that flying again. Maybe two of them. But from what we hear, they're still having troubles with the engines at the historic flight, I think.
Two together would be lovely. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Sorry about the meowing cat.
Oh. I do have a page on Facebook that I call Geezer Stew, which is where I post all the humorous stuff. That
Geezer Stew?
Geezer Stew, yeah.
Oh, I've got to look for that. Did you say Facebook?
Facebook, yeah.
Well, Tim, the one question I wanted to ask that the conversation just didn't go that way, which is, you know, what's your best, worst passenger story?
I've had a pretty charmed life on disasters. I haven't had too much happen. I've had some good funny stories. We had a gentleman taxi in, I think it was Washington, D.C. The people in the front row of coach were waving me back, and I go back there, and they said, well, he's not responding. He's pale. And, you know, sure enough, you know, he seemed to have passed out, so we got him down onto the floor. And a few rows back, there was a nurse, and she said, you know, I'll help and check him out. And she couldn't get a pulse off his neck. She couldn't get a pulse off his wrist. So then she loosens his pants and tries to go for a pulse down out of his groin, and she puts her hand down his pants, and he goes, whoa now! So I think we found the new way to bring passengers back to life. Go for the groin. Oh.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. As always, you've been very busy interacting with us on Facebook, Twitter, emails and the such. On Facebook, Glenn Towler responded to a post we put on about the use of cameras in the cockpit. He said he didn't feel there was anything wrong with it. Never has an aircraft been put at risk by such behaviour. Danny responded with a great response about distracting pilots. And over on Twitter, Ken Knudsen, he said he was happy that pilots used cameras as long as he can walk off the plane intact at the gate. There was, however, an issue, I believe it was last year, on an RAF aircraft where cameras were deemed to be the cause of an incident. Where do you guys stand on the use of pilots using cameras in the cockpit?
You're certainly right about the Air Force. It was a Voyager crew, tanker crew. That incident. It's a difficult one because
it is, isn't it? It's really tricky.
The ability that we've got now to capture these images and these films, these GoPro, we kind of, the other cameras are available, but we kind of all refer to them as the GoPro. it's like a Hoover, isn't it?
Yeah.
In some ways, what they do is that they open up a world that to most people is it's a dream world in some ways. We aren't going to go flying through valleys in an F-18 Hornet, or we're not going to see the northern lights from the cockpit of a Dreamliner, or whatever it might be. So I think it's really important that those images and these sights and sounds are captured and are made available to as many people as possible, because I think it's broadening the whole thing out. It has to be done in a completely and utterly safe manner. There's no question about that. And I think the best people to judge that are the men and women that are in the cockpit themselves.
You raise an important point there, I think, Gareth, in that sharing this, since 2001, the old days where, a pilot or a captain could get a child, and go and show them the flight deck and put them in open the cockpit door, put them on the flight deck and show, this is what I do for a living, and instill that spark or love of aviation, that then they go off and dream about being a pilot or dream about being an engineer or want to get involved. That's gone. You cannot do this now. So if the regulators, and this is a personal opinion here, not my employers, if the regulators were to sort of come down heavy and say, look, no photo, I think this would have a detrimental effect on getting future generations interested in aviation.
Yeah, agreed. The challenge is, of course, that the regulations state that the cockpits should be sterile, and it really is a challenging one. But let's move on. Joseph Chung, good supporter of the show, has posted a couple of videos for us up on Facebook. Joe, thanks very much for that. We'll put links to those in the show notes. There's one that he states, aircraft engineering is something I'd love to become, but it's a serious job. On a lighter note, here's why you shouldn't go looking for that turbine blade when someone's doing an engine reverse brake test. So I'll put a link to that one. You have to see it to appreciate what he's talking about. Moving on, Neil Braden had started off a discussion on his Facebook feed following a fantastic video showing some Airbus aircraft, interestingly enough, many of the shots from inside the cockpit. He loved it, and I asked the question, and he says he's a Boeing guy. So I asked the question, what makes a Boeing guy versus an Airbus guy? And it started off a long debate. Tomislav Kozovetovich, I do apologise if I've got your pronunciation wrong, Tomislav, did respond positively about the interesting side and the benefits of Airbus aircraft. And that started off a whole debate. So we put a note on our Facebook page, and Neil McCarthy, good friend of the show, jumped in and said he's a Boeing man, and that's probably because he's bought a 737 full-size simulator. So we'll just park that one for the moment, because I want to come back to that. But so what's your views on this, guys? You Boeing people or Airbus people or what?
It's like Man U versus Arsenal, isn't it, really? It's a bit tribal, you know. If you've grown up in Seattle or Toulouse, you know, chances are you are going to root for the home team, or maybe I've heard, you know, one of the things I've heard in the military sort of side of things is, you know, the pilot will always fall in love with their first aircraft. You know, their first aircraft, the first real aircraft they fly after training. You know, it doesn't matter what they go on to after that. That is the one they love. I don't know.
I flew a Piper Tomahawk first. I can tell you right now, I didn't fall in love with that aircraft. But obviously not in the league of these guys. How about you, Gareth? Where are you on this?
I could give two hoots, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a sign that I'm, you know, I'm not
quite neutral, you know,
commercial aviation is not my first love. Let's put it that way. So I've never really found myself in a position where I felt as if I needed to make a choice between one or the other. I know guys that I know, or some of the guys that I know that fly for the airlines are very tribal about it, and a very old friend of mine who I won't mention him by name, but he's a 737 pilot for British Airways, and he's going to stay on that fleet until the lights go out. He's rejected every opportunity to go over to the Airbus fleet and such like. He's not interested, absolutely not interested. He just wants to stay exactly where he is. And he doesn't want anything to do with Airbus. That's not flying, as far as he's concerned.
Right,
yeah, he's quite old school.
Yeah,
and that's just one example of how, you know, fervent this, as Tim says, how tribal this argument can be. From my point of view, I couldn't care less.
There was an interesting aside. I went to see Airbus before Christmas, had a look at their A350 training setup, which is subject to an upcoming article in aerospace. And one of the things they have to do is that there's several conversion courses, you know, going from the A330, which is the shortest, from something like an A320 to the, so there's several steps, and they've got to have this certified by the regulators, both by the FAA and by EASA. And one of the guys there said was, you know, we had to get commercial airline pilots to, in order to certify. We had to find commercial airline pilots with no Airbus fly-by-wire experience whatsoever. Yeah, that's the baseline. That's the thing. Baseline. You kind of can you train someone up to be in a command? And he said, it's getting harder and harder now to find these people.
Well, I interviewed a while ago Carleen Pettit, who many on social media will be aware of. She's a A330 pilot. Now, she was a Czech captain on the 747-400, which she absolutely loves. But having flown the A330 for quite some time, she loves it. And so when I asked her the question, she made that very point. She loves the 747. She always will, and she loves Boeing aircraft, but she really enjoys flying the Airbuses now. So it's horses for courses. But what we want to know is what you are. Are you a Boeing person, or are you an Airbus person? But what we want to know is why. So tweet, email, Facebook, get in touch with us and let us know. Now let's come back to Mr. Neil McCarthy. 737 full-size flight simulator, and apparently by February it'll have three either simulators or cockpits again. We know he's a bit of a hoarder. We know he collects these things, and he's been a great supporter of the show. Gareth, what's he up to this time?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I know from chatting to Neil this summer, he came down to display at Dawlish air show for us in the JP3. I know that he'd been looking around for these, and I've got no idea what he's going to do. I mean, this is the guy that bought, you know, a vampire cockpit, made national news because it was parked on the drive of his house for a few months. That's now rather beautifully a museum at Kinloss in Scotland, I believe, is now on display there. I don't know what he's going to do. You never know with Neil.
Well, we'll try and get Neil back on the show maybe in a month or two's time to find out what he's up to. But a little bird tells me that you're getting a little bit interested after our recent episode on flight simulation, Gareth, in the old simulators.
I've been re-bitten by the bug, and I had a little bit of time earlier this month, so I treated my computer to a new graphics card. Nothing particularly fancy, about £50 worth to replace the sort of bog standard one that came with it. I chucked a little bit of extra RAM in the computer and then bought Flight Simulator X, but probably more importantly DCS World, which I know that Tim Robinson immerses himself in when he gets an opportunity. I haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what is a very complicated and in-depth flight simulator, but even I have to say, on the first few sort of attempts, it's great fun. It looks fantastic, and it's beautifully done, and quite looking forward to getting into that. And Tim's already talking about doing some sort of A-10 two ship strike missions and stuff, so we'll keep you posted. You know, by the time we record next, maybe we'll have a few hours under our belts jointly, and see how terrible I've been.
Yeah, we've been put on a display.
Oh my god, you imagine. Wow. Yeah, great fun though. And that's largely down to Derek, wasn't it, who was on from PC Pilot, and so back in the world of flight sim. Brilliant for these long winter evenings.
Definitely.
Okay, over to promoting aerospace then. Tim, let's kick off with you. Have you got anything to give a shout out about?
Nothing specific. So I think what I'll probably do with a little bit of indulgence is just a heads up for the society's events. So, events in 2015, got some really interesting stuff happening. January, there's lectures on Hawker Hunter, biological inspiration for air vehicles, Tiger Moths, advanced layer manufacturing. We've got Red Arrows Part 1, NATS, civil air-to-air refueling, Vulcans, air tankers, flying shuttle with aircraft, the whole lot. So, have a look on our website, www.aerosociety.com. If you're in the area, RAS lecture is well worth it. And most of them, the vast majority of them, are usually free.
The other thing that you can do on some of your lectures is you do release them as programs, podcasts. I was catching up on a few over the Christmas break. The one by the managing director of Heathrow, is it? Or chief exec of Heathrow Airport. Yep. Excellent listen. Really enjoyed that. So there's another source of a support for the society you can give, as well as really entertaining aviation and aerospace content. Gareth, how about you?
Yeah, I just wanted mine's Red Arrows related, actually, because relatively new to social media on Twitter is Monty, Squadron Leader David Montenegro. He's the new Red One, the new team leader of the Royal Air Force aerobatic team. He's a top guy. You'll find him at RAF Red One on Twitter. So give, it must be, I'm hoping to get to talk to him at some point in the new year. It must be a really, exciting, what an honour, but it must be a really daunting job to take on. I think that's pretty interesting. You know, they are, after all, a sort of national icon, a national treasure. So go and give Monty a follow and give him plenty of support, because I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
We'll put links to that in the show notes. A couple of shout-outs from me. First is an organisation I came across I didn't know anything about, called flytohelp.org, and they inspire changing people's lives through the wonder of flight. So we'll put a link to them in our show notes as well. Really great organisation with some great affiliates supporting the work they do. And finally, another podcast by a colleague, by the name of Carl Valeri. He runs several programs, but one's called Aviation Careers Podcast. You can find it at aviationcareerpodcast.com, where Carl, who is an airline pilot in the US, works his way around the industry, highlighting careers within the airline sector in particular, and how to get into them, and gives a little insight to that. So if you're interested in a career in the airline business, not always in the pointy end of the aircraft, but all across the whole sector, give Carl's podcast a listen. It's well worth it. Okay, that just about brings us to the end of the program. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contribution, and also our special inserts in this episode. They come from Betty in the Sky with a Suitcase. That's a program all about the adventures and stories from a flight attendant for a major US airline. Of course, the Airplane Geeks podcast, who many of you know is, of course, the most popular aviation program around at the moment. And finally, to my favourite, Adam Carolla, and thank you for the use of their media. Now, we use Twitter and Facebook as our main engagement tools in between episodes, so if you don't follow us, then you miss out on some of the stuff we've already talked about in the show. So look us up at Aviation Extended, or one word, both on Twitter and Facebook. Final plea, we're dropping down the iTunes rankings and we need your support. We've got lots of new listeners. Please, please, can you rate us and leave us feedback on iTunes? It's really important to keep our ratings up there. If we don't get the ratings, the program drops off and people are not able to find it. So that would really help us out. Finally, our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. And please do ask before using anything you hear. Okay, chaps, whereabouts can we find you online? Tim, let's start with you.
Yep, I'm on Twitter at RESTimR. And also my website can be found, Royal Aeronautical Society's website can be found at www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth?
Yeah, globalaviationresource.com for everything GAR related. And I'm Gareth_Stringer on Twitter. And just to reiterate what Peter just said, please, please give us that rating, because it's not actually that many people in the UK doing this. So it'll be a shame to see us drop down a little bit, wouldn't it? So that'll be a nice Christmas present for us. If you haven't rated us already, please do so.
Yeah, that would be very, very great. We'd be very grateful for that. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. Before we go, we'd like to wish you all a very, very happy 2015. It's been a great 2014. We hope you've enjoyed the show, the content, the guests we've brought you. We've had a great time doing it. We're really looking forward to 2015. So happy new year to you all from the team here at Extended. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye, happy new year.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. Happy New Year, and see you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
What does a turnip go in a cloud eating it in a giant cloud?
I don't know. What is it?
Giant tasting it on the clouds.
Right, say it again properly.
And you're listening to Extended.
And you're listening to Extended.
And you're, and me, now I'm listening to Extended.
No. Some fantastic content for you today. We'd like to thank all our... start all that again. I've got it written in front of me. It's not hard, is it?
We'd like to thank all of the... Start that again.
Sorry, chaps. All right, I'll do that again. Over to this show. Thank you very much for continuing to listen. And for those who are our regular... Oh, come on. Who's had wine? I haven't had wine.
I have.
Right, sorry, guys. Sorry. One more time. We record this on the 29th of December and are... I'm going to throw
what
this
are
at...
We?
Yeah,
what are we?
We've got a great interview with somebody... Oh, come on, what is going on? Sorry, guys. I'm just going to go and have a quick swig of water and come back, I promise.
Do it.
Quid. It's got to be done, hasn't it?
Right. I haven't got any wine close to hand, but anyway, let's start again. Come on.
You want me to send you some via Skype? Why can't we do that? We should be able to do that.
You can do almost everything else, can't we? Anyway, Okay, let me do it now. Let me say that again. Someone's going to bloody complain, aren't they? 3, 2, 1.
Just going to say, 3 simulators, Peter Johnson, Tim Robinson, Gareth Stringer.
Yeah,
we could have our own virtual Air Force.
We could. We could.
Should we contract out the training?
Extended Airlines is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
You thought you'd seen low cost. You've seen nothing yet.
I was talking, obviously. Babble. Obviously, to myself.
Episode 36.
Do it again. Won't be the first time. 3, 2, 1. Faffing about, spitting my teeth out earlier on in the winging it does not always work very well.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.